Hello, world singers. My name is Tyler.
And my name is Brooke.
And this is Cosmere Conversations. Welcome back, everyone. We have a very exciting episode, and just a bunch of exciting stuff has been happening lately in not the Cosmere so much as the fandom of the Cosmere. It's been an exciting springtime, and we're just going to keep that train of fun rolling as we set up this episode where we're going to look back at the different secret projects and try to connect them forward to what we're expecting in Stormlight Archive 5 coming out later this year.
Coming soon.
Very soon. And we have really just been inundated with a bunch of stuff going on in the community lately. There was the Words of Radiance Leatherbound backer kit, not Kickstarter this time, and the announcement of another secret project, a secret project. All of this stuff is really exciting, and we promise we're going to get to it, but not this episode. We're going to leave off a lot of the commentary on what's going on in the community until our next episode, because we have a very special guest to join us and talk about Tress of the Emerald Sea. Co-hosting this episode with us will be Jennifer Neal from Dragonsteel. She works in creative development at Dragonsteel and was kind enough to join us to talk all about Tress and maybe kind of throw out some crazy theories that she can help get an extra perspective on. So Jen, thank you so much for being here.
Welcome to the podcast.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We first met Jen at Dragonsteel Con this past fall. She was on a panel, a really awesome panel, and is super involved in the fandom and all of the crazy things that we're all saying all the time. So we're really happy to have her enthusiasm here on the podcast with us as we look at Tress and what it might mean for Stormlight Archive.
Yeah, try to make all of those connections and maybe theorize a little bit, speculate quite a bit about what the addition of Tress means to the Cosmere and what we can expect going forward into Stormlight Archive.
Let's start with a little bit of an introduction. Jen, what Order of Knights Radiant would you say you most align with?
Well, most of the time when I get asked this question, my number one order that I would go with is Edge Dancer. Really, I feel like I'm a little bit of a blend between Edge Dancer as well as Elsecaller and Truth Watcher. For a long time, I thought I was an Elsecaller, mostly just because I thought Edge Dancer sounded really boring. And eventually I had a friend kind of make me realize I think it's boring because it's like my everyday life. Like, that's just the life that I live is. I've realized that Edge Dancers are like the social workers of the Cosmere, and I'm not really a social worker, but I did study that for a long time, and it's something I have a strong passion for. So I just thought it sounded boring and mundane, and I was like, oh, it's why. It's because it's me.
Right. That's so funny. I love that comparison as the social workers of the Cosmere. I think that's perfect.
Yes, with superpowers, which would be great for all social workers in every universe to just be able to come to those difficult situations with some extra superpowers. So all respect to the Edge Dancers. I am curious, though, what is it about the Elsecallers that kind of draws your interest?
Part of it is just that I really identify with Yasna a lot. I don't know how much of, you know, her character is not entirely just being an Elsecaller, but even the parts of her character that are not, that I just identify with her a lot. And I've identified with the Elsecaller ideal a lot of trying to reach your potential. I'm very much a lifelong learner type person. I love learning new skills and development, and all of that stuff is great. So I feel like that's very much an Elsecaller quality.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just playing the fact that I've taken the quiz, and they usually do, like, those three are just the top three, like, objectively according to the quiz.
Which is very Elsecaller of you. Be like, what's the objective stats that we actually have here? Yasna would be proud. Yeah. Well, just to round out the trio, I know we've talked about it a bunch, but how do you fare when it comes to the Order of Knights Radiant quiz?
I also am an Edge Dancer. I actually recently retook the quiz just to see if anything had changed since I last took it a couple years ago when it first came out. And I actually got substantially different results, which I thought was really interesting. In this most recent quiz, Edge Dancer was definitely the top. And then I think the two below were like Windrunner and now I don't remember what the third one was, but very different from when I've taken it in the past. It might have been Bondsmith.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Bondsmith for you. That's a good one. But there's only three. Or as far as we know, there can only be three.
True. Bondsmiths, yes.
Well, I still rank very highly on the Windrunner with a little bit of Stone Ward. And then third one doesn't even matter. They're just like, no, you're either Windrunner or Stone Ward.
You very clearly sorted into that category.
Unfortunately, if there's a war, I will be somewhere in the front lines of that situation. That's my only job in this. And I think that while the Orders of the Knights Radiant are kind of like what we're getting excited about for Stormlight Archive 5, this episode is a little bit about looking back at Tress of the Emerald Sea specifically. And so, Jen, was there anything about Tress that you particularly love, the stories, the characters, or are you all about those crazy connections?
I mean, I did really love Tress. There were a lot of things I really liked about Tress. One of them was just kind of the character herself. Mm-hmm. I felt like she was a really unique character, especially in the way that she doesn't doubt herself. I love that she doesn't put herself down, even though it's not like she sees herself as perfect or even particularly special. She acknowledges that to her, she's completely ordinary. And I think the book kind of reinforces that she is a pretty ordinary, average person. But I feel like so many of us see that as a bad thing. And I love that she just doesn't see anything wrong with that. It doesn't stop her from trying new things, from exploring, you know, doing all of the spore stuff that she does. She doesn't think that she's just unqualified and therefore can't do it. And I think that's just a really unique character that, I mean, I don't see in the world in real life people very often as well as in characters. So I love that part of Tress.
Yeah, I think that's such a good call out. Tress is such an interesting character in that, in her neutrality, she's like not overconfident, but not insecure. And she's not super smart, but she's also not super dumb. She like doesn't really struggle. I mean, she struggles a little bit with kind of her self-image, but she always pushes through and accomplishes what she needs to accomplish. But also she accomplishes those things with help from other people.
Yes, the
Duggs.
She's
not obviously the Duggs. She is not the sort of single genius or like single hero that we see so often.
Yeah, it certainly is my favorite part of Tress as well. I think Brandon has a line in there when he's like, now pay attention very clearly. I guess this is Hoyd talking rather than Brandon, but saying...
Same.
Yeah, we'll maybe discuss that in a theorizing perspective a little bit later. But bringing attention to the fact that she's about to do something very, very important, and that's not rush into judgment to ask around for help and to get a second opinion.
Yeah, that she like steps back and is like, I should think about this more.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And
there's a lot of those really refreshing moments with her where she just is taking it slow. I love the way that her parents are involved and supportive. You know, you don't get that in fantasy like ever.
Totally. Yeah.
On rereading Tress, that really did stand out is the moment, I think it's a chapter, maybe like 5 or 6, so really early on, but it's about her father. And her father is going around to the people in town and he's not saying anything directly, but he is getting their assistance and their cooperation by like calling in favors and, you know, reminding people who has been around their entire lives helping them out. It's Tress's father. And so when he needs something, when she needs something, it is the whole community that's coming together. And that's at the beginning. And then we kind of relearn that throughout the story on the ship as the Duggs become singular characters and they make those connections with Tress. It's all really lovely. And it also sets up a bunch of crazy Cosmere speculation because we have dragons, we have Hoyd, we have Elantrians, we have spaceships, we have a new type of bond. All of these things are kind of subtly introduced, which is why I think it's maybe one of my favorite secret projects, if not my favorite secret project.
I know we said we weren't going to dive into like new stuff too much, but Dragons are going to be important, and we have a dragon here in Tress.
Yeah, that's a little tease for the future episode when we go over all of the newest releases about secret projects and kind of what's going on there. But let's stay focused. Let's stay on track and start with Jen. Do you have any particular connections from Tress or important things that you believe will be significant going forward in the Cosmere or to Stormlight directly?
I'm not coming into this conversation with a whole lot of those. Like, I think there's some obvious connections. Like, I think there's some other subtler ones, but I think this conversation is going to make me think about that all a little more because I haven't really given it a lot of thought before.
Yeah. One way that I think there's at least some connection between these two worlds is the types of bonds that we see, because mm-hmm. of course in Tress we start to see the Luhel bond, which based on the name at least seems to be somewhat related or similar to the Nahel bond that we see on Rashar. There is the similarity in the exchange aspect of it, which seems to be kind of an underlying Cosmere principle, but they do differ in maybe their complexity. Like the Luhel bond is based on the exchange of a physical thing, water in this case, in exchange for the ability to manipulate or affect mm-hmm. the aether. And then the mm-hmm. Nahel bond is exchanging Stormlight power investiture for sapience.
Yeah, there's definitely an exchange. There's also an important connection to the physical realm because Spren are a little bit more cognitive realm based. And
yeah.
So they want more of that connection just to the physical realm, which is similar to how water is very directly, you know, from the physical realm, an element that is wanted and desired in the exchange that those aethers have. We actually first see the Luhel bond on display with Twinsel in the Lost mm-hmm. Metal. And then the bonds that we see in Tress are kind of unique, or
yeah,
they're like
they're
a subset of the Aethers and kind of unique to what is going on Lumar specifically, and maybe different from like the prime Aethers. We have
yeah.
the Aethers of Lumar, and so their bonds are maybe even different from regular Luhel bonds.
I think we can say that for sure, and they seem to be a more temporary version of the bond, more, even more of an exchange than a relationship that is built via bond.
I was thinking about this a little bit differently until you mentioned what you said, Tyler, because I was thinking of Nahel bonds as maybe like the higher bond because of the way it involves more investment from both parties and like the agreement that's involved and everything. And Luhel seems like it's a lesser thing because it is very transactional and it doesn't necessarily require the other party to be particularly sapient or to approve of how you're using the thing that you're getting in exchange and all of that. So I was kind of thinking of it as like Nahel bonds are things that you form with sapient creatures and Luhel bonds are things that you would form with lesser creatures that maybe have more of an animalistic drive. But you mentioned like the prime aethers, which I'm pretty sure would fall into that more sapient category as that being a Luhel bond as well. So I do think, yeah, maybe that can go both ways a little more. I'm going to assume I feel like from like a power equivalency level, you must get more out of a Luhel bond that's with something that's like a prime aether that's that wise and intelligent in a way that the other things are not. Like there must be, you know, some
yeah.
limits on how far that can go. That's really interesting though.
We certainly see quite a bit more direct control that Twinsel has over the aethers. Now he's experienced as well, and maybe not every person who's able to use.
Well, and he can also communicate with the prime aether.
Yes. And so I think that certainly is more akin to a Nahel bond with a Spren, and maybe even most comparable to something like a bondsmith bond, you know, Dalinar and the Stormfather, because it is kind of like an entity that is old and has a lot of maybe wisdom, but also not a perfect understanding of like what it means to be human. And
mm-hmm.
so that's kind of what it's gaining in the relationship. But certainly the relationship with the prime aethers seems closer to a Nahel bond. And then what we see on display in Tress is even variations within, because Tress herself is said to have an affinity for the verdant aether, but there's also spore eaters, which are like more directly controlled by the aether, and it's less voluntary in that relationship.
Yeah, I don't know if that counts as a bond.
Exactly. It's almost like a kind of taking over in a way, which does bring me back, as is my normal cadence, to return to mushrooms, because Brandon introduced a planet full of spores. And of course, I was going to think about all the different possible connections that we see with mushrooms and how those exist in Tress, because I think that
mushrooms don't exist in Tress.
I mean, if they're spores, then there's mushrooms.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The spores themselves are coming from something. They are coming from the
Coming from the moons.
Yes.
And aethers.
They're not moons. They're mushrooms.
Exactly. That's it. We've made the connection, Jen. You've got it.
Don't encourage him.
This is wonderful. Thank you for jumping on the mushroom bandwagon. And very quickly, I just think, yes, if the moons were like a main source of the mushrooms, of the spores, then a lot of what we see in Tress is similar, because mushrooms have the ability to form networks of mycelium, and they're able to connect, you know, over large distances, maybe even over whole planets. And they do that through the spread of their spores. We see lines when it comes to the midnight essence that are connecting the user, the person who has the bond, with the little avatar or the little moppet that they'll create, and that forms a connection. There's lines back to them, and those lines can be severed, and they can be severed with silver. And the other thing that reacts strongly and protects from the spores is salt. They have that quote, salt and silver halt the killer.
Yeah.
And in our world, two things that are used to combat mushroom growth, if you wanted to, would be salt and silver.
I don't think it needs to be silver.
Silver is like a, there's like a silver powder that you put on mushrooms and it kills them, clogs up their little pores or whatnot, and impacts them.
Okay.
And so.
But silver across the Cosmere is used in more ways than that.
Very true.
Curious, based on Tress and Shadows for Silence, what effect silver would have on Rashar. I don't know if we've necessarily seen anything like that. Of course, at the end of Words of Radiance, we get the Racium dagger that can be flipped to conduct investiture in different ways. Would silver do anything to a Nahel bond if we see it being effective in a variant of the Luhel bond?
That's a good question. And I think we should keep an eye out for silver. Do you have any insights on like either how spores react to silver or salt or any other metals in general, Jen?
I don't have much on the silver. I'm still, like you guys, trying to figure out what exactly this is and how it kind of is different from aluminum. Like, they seem like they're different forms of doing the same thing a lot of the time, just kind of stopping investiture in some way. But I don't have any specific thoughts on how that one works. I do love that, of course, like the way that the other metals work is reflective of how they work in Allomancy and how they work on Roshar. And they just kind of have these properties whenever they interact with investiture. It kind of does the same thing. Like, I think that is a really fun mechanical thing to play with. And I just think it creates so many ways that we as fans can kind of play with and develop our own thoughts on ways that these could be used. I'm sure someone's come up with some really funny, dumb way to use, like, you know, iron and steel to do something fun. But I think that's a lot of fun. But I mean, it's gotten to the point that it's a little bit expected almost. Like, of course, that's what it would do to the Aethers after we saw what it did in Rhythm of War. But I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point of the kind of consistency of the metal system across the Cosmere. And that's such a kind of comforting thing that we know every time we see these metals, they're going to behave at least in similar ways. And in that same vein, I think there is a lot of fans kind of trying to map other versions of magic in the Cosmere to each other. For example, I saw something online trying to kind of map the 12 aethers to the 10 essences on Rishar and see like how these things interact. There are some things that seem to be sort of related. For example, they both have an element called Zephyr, which is like air. They both have what on Rishar they call Lucentia, which is described as quartz. And then, of course, the Rosite Aether being very quartzy looking, but they don't totally map in a way that like makes sense. And I think sometimes we get too into categories, which I totally understand. Like, I want everything to like fit in its little neat box and like match up perfectly so that I can make a map that's really pretty.
It's got to look good on the Excel sheet. You need to be able to directly connect. How do you feel about those types of, you know, really large connections when they're trying to map all the spores to all the essences or all the orders of Knight's Radiance to like what's going on with the metals?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Brooke, that it's like, it's really nice to know how these practically work, but I, you know, it's also really nice to have things that are surprises and that don't make sense and that kind of do strange things that we can't predict. It's nice to have a balance between those two things. I think I tend to lean towards wanting Aethers to be different, especially because of their claim that, I mean, you know, we don't know for sure, but their claim that they don't belong to Aiden Alzheimer, but they're something separate, makes me think that like maybe they should have something to completely different. You know, Aiden Alzheimer has the 10 surges, and then these guys have, you know, their 12 of something that's not intended to be able to map the same. I don't know. I tend to move away from those sorts of things anyway. Like, I know there's the whole, you can map the shards under the Dawn shards in like groups of four and whatever. I tend to not want to do that. I don't like it, even though I think Brandon's practically confirmed that like that's a thing that can be done. I'm just like, I don't want them to be that neat. I kind of want a little bit of chaos in it. So I'm interested in seeing how these can be different. And also because I know Brandon kind of, you know, developed this system with the idea of how these aethers can be used like in technology to help him with the space age development. And so I think, you know, having total flexibility in how he does that and what it's going to be able to create is fun. So I don't mind if they don't match, like not everything has to have a correlation.
Being able to add like new things into the system so that we can achieve new things, I think is a great call out.
And we're certainly going to need a lot of development, but that is one of the things that we see on display, that Tress is playing around with how to combine different spores and sometimes using little metal triggers within the bombs or the creations that she is making. And I think that's where there is the potential to have a lot of fun. I was never that big into it, but I know that the recent Zelda game, there was a ability to kind of like build and construct based on the player's creation and imagination. It was like the game gave you some basic tools, some basic abilities, but importantly, they gave you the ability to connect things together. So you could like strap 10 rocket ships onto a plank of wood and then just like launch yourself on a plank and see how high you go. But it really was determined by what the player wanted to do with that. And that's where I think Brandon has now all of these little building blocks, and then he can put them together however he sees fit, but also readers can try to put things together as they see fit, and then that might be different.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I played the new Zelda game, so I know what you're talking about, and I just barely got into Zelda, so that was the first one I played, and now I'm going back and I'm playing Breath of the Wild, the one before it, so lovely. I'm doing it totally backwards. But one thing I've noticed doing it in that order is that in Breath of the Wild, some of the challenges feel very repetitive, and it's kind of just playing with the same things. But because they have that building aspect, every single shrine you go to in Tears of the Kingdom is very different and unique, and the challenge is you have to think really outside of the box. And I think that's one of the pros of that kind of thing that Brandon has here. When we understand the magic as well as we do, is that it opens up that door of having so many things that you can do, you know, in Tears of the Kingdom, because you can just build stuff. You can go through shrines totally in a way that you were not supposed to do them, because they just can't develop the game in a way where it's, you can only do it the one way that they intended to be done, because they've just opened it up so much. I think that's a big benefit for Brandon, is having, you know, all of these surges that you can play with in any way that you want, and these aethers that you can play with in any way that you want. It makes it so wide, and so many different things can come out of it. I don't necessarily read fan fiction or anything, but I feel like it gives those people a lot to play with, like a lot of adventure to have. So I think it's a really cool thing.
Yeah, and we've always talked about and sometimes had very silly episodes when we are slamming together new powers and powers that haven't met in the Cosmere yet. But, mm-hmm. you know, how would those things interact? And Brandon has talked about resonance points between yeah. two different power sets.
How they interact at that middle point.
Yeah, so I think all of these things are great. But yes, I think among us, we're all saying they don't perfectly line up. It's not meant to be a one-to-one connection from the essences over to the spores. And that, at least it seems to us, is a benefit rather than a harm.
Mm-hmm. And I think this comes into the conversation that's happening a lot around Tress about Midnight Essence and the Midnight Mother and Midnight Spores in Tress and like how all of these things are related. One of our patrons reached out and asked us to talk about the relationship between Midnight Spores and the Midnight creatures that Dalinar comes into contact with in Way of Kings. And there are some great quotes about this. It's not exactly a coincidence, but this phenomenon, I guess, that sort of give us some insights into how these types of connections or types of mirroring through the Cosmere work. We have a word of Brandon saying, quote, "Multiple magic systems will reach the same conclusion. When something is done to the magic to corrupt it, it becomes like Midnight Essence. So while there are similarities between the two and they work the same, they may not have the same point of origin," end quote. And I think the really important, like, overarching part from that is that multiple magic systems will reach the same conclusion. So it may not be a situation where, like, a midnight spore ended up on Rashar and then it gained sapience like a spren and became the Midnight Mother, and like they're actually literally the same thing. But it's more that in some way Midnight Essence is a fundamental aspect of the Cosmere, and so it has independently arisen in multiple places.
Right. You said the most important part of the quote was that magic systems reach the same conclusion. I actually think the most important part is the end when he says they may reach the same conclusion, but they don't have the same point of origin.
Right.
So this concept of parallel evolution, there might be another word.
Convergent evolution.
Convergent is definitely when they like meet together eventually and they converge and have the same end result. So that's what Brandon is talking about. I wonder how many different lines there are of evolution. Mm. And so are Aethers on their own separate line? Are they going to converge eventually? You know, in the future of the Cosmere, are all of these things going to kind of wrap into one another or be forced into one another by human involvement, human or other species in the Cosmere? But I think that if you have different magic systems that are developing completely separately, that is more interesting and unique than always having like one source as the beginning.
Yeah,
because then it's too easy to track exactly what's going to play out, because they're like, you're bound by the rules of where you started. You can't get outside of that realm. But if you can start mm-hmm. as far apart as, you know, different planets or different parts or times of the Cosmere, and you're still somehow moving towards a couple of, you know, in quotes, truths of the Cosmere, like there will always be some type of midnight essence, some type of corruption. I think that's more unique in the same way we were talking about with like the labeling of the systems. It's actually a little bit more unique if you can have wildly different origin points.
But you bring up the idea that midnight essence is a potential signal of corruption, which I also think is interesting. And I don't know if I really understand what Brandon meant by that part of that quote. When something is done to magic to corrupt it, it becomes like Midnight Essence. Does that mean it's like it's not Midnight Essence, but it is similar to it? Or
yeah, this is really weird to me. Yeah. Because I'm like, you've talked a lot about corruption, Brandon, and like the whole like it becomes red and now we're having this other thing. Not that I think these things are totally like conflicting with each other, but I do think it's funny that it's like it's both of these things. And I think we must be talking about like different versions of corruption. So you know, we could have a conversation maybe about like certain corruption gives like the red thing, and then certain corruption makes the Midnight Essence thing. But even that kind of, it starts to feel weird, because I feel like he's suggesting that Midnight Essence is the same as like the nightmares and Nightbloods like black smoke. And I don't feel like they are the same.
I don't either. Yeah, I think Midnight Essence is a different thing from that type of corruption or just that type of investiture processing, I guess.
Yeah, I think there is something, there's something here, though. They're not the same thing, but you bring up Nightblood, and I'm thinking of the Father Machine in Yumi. Don't want to jump over to that story too much, but the black miasma that is released is some byproduct of what is being taken in by the Father Machine. Some byproduct of what Nightblood is taking in is the black smoke.
It's like there's an inefficient process or like an inefficient reaction happening.
Right. And so maybe what Brandon
Midnight Essence seems to be like its own thing.
Yeah. Maybe what Brandon is talking about, though, is like a sense of balance or an equilibrium, and that everything has the potential to be knocked out of its equilibrium, which could be labeled as corruption. It's like not in perfect balance anymore. And then a lot of different stuff can happen after that or because of its out of balanceness.
Yeah.
Like maybe
that's kind of interesting thinking about the midnight spores, which are seem to be more advanced than the other types of spores. They're able to achieve more sentience. They take more water. The bond is a little bit stronger. So if we think about that as being sort of out of balance in a way, I think that's interesting.
I also wonder if maybe the Midnight Essence is like a, almost like a form that the smoky, you know, Nightblood, Midnight, or Nightmare stuff takes, like when it's being controlled or directed by like a more intentional force. It seems like, you know, the nightmares, like they take a form as they're doing something, but like they kind of are also just like very floating and not really being controlled by the Father Machine most of the time until he like forms them into the people and stuff. And then Nightblood, you know, it's just giving off this stuff. It's not doing anything. It's just kind of dissipating. I wonder if it's like, you know, the condensed version of this smokiness is how you end up with this Midnight Essence stuff that has that totally different texture.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think this is fun speculation, and I don't think we're done with Midnight Essences or Midnight Spores.
Yeah.
And certainly not done with the Midnight Mother, but this is probably one of the more important connections that Tress allows us to theorize about, but it's also one of the least explored parts of each of these stories. Brandon clearly has something that he's playing with here and introducing different versions of the Midnight. And we are not quite there figuring it out, but I think we know that there's something to figure out.
I want to talk about another really strong connection between Tress and Rashar and the Stormlight Archive and bring the conversation back to dragons.
Okay, let's
do it. Which are going to be important because I think probably the strongest connection between these two stories comes in the Ars Arcanum from Rhythm of War. We've read this quote so many times on the podcast. I'm not going to read the whole thing again. Y'all will know what I'm talking about. But Chris says that the fact that anti-investiture can only be created by intent is an important piece of information for achieving control over the Aethers, which is Foil, aka Zysis, is goal.
Yeah. And that was the first time we saw a mention of Foil. So obviously that made everybody jump with joy. New thing we don't understand, to eventually make the connection over to Zysis. So we like, we've seen part of that goal or that process that Zysis has to try to understand intent, the spores, and the Aethers.
And anti-investiture.
And anti-investiture, and how all those things work together.
And as a reminder, Zysis's research is about how spores break down and the water cycle on Lumar and how the seethe works. That's why he's at the bottom of the ocean there. I don't know what to do with like all of these little disparate pieces of information or like what they actually mean together, but it seems important to me and I just want us to all remember.
So Jen, we're hoping that you can take all of the different pieces and put them together.
Be for my us. Hero.
Yes. What do you think about anti-investiture and Zysis's goal and plan of controlling the Aethers?
I mean, I think I'm not going to be a lot of help. Sorry.
Just more questions is what we do here.
Yeah, yeah. I actually didn't think it was so much about the anti-investiture, and it seems like it's more about studying intent, because, you know, that's what she mentions is like the thing that's important to the anti-investiture. And so it seems like maybe investiture is like, or intent is just what she's getting at, that like, obviously intent is involved when you're playing with aethers and with the spores. And it makes me wonder if intent is involved when it comes to the seed and like the decomposition of aethers. I don't have any idea how that would work, but it seems to be like the connection that she's drawing is that, you know, what Zeiss is trying to understand about how that works is somehow related to intent of somebody or something somewhere, maybe.
That's interesting.
I do like that quite a bit. It, again, comes back to more mushroom theory, which I've left behind in the past. But if you have a network and that network is fairly basic and simple, then it's relatively boring. You can use it, you cannot. Think of like a highway between two cities. But as the network grows in complexity, eventually at some point, the network begins to mimic a brain or like the base structure of a brain. And you can imagine thousands of synapses and electrical signals being sent back and forth. At what level of complexity is or are all of the aethers around Lumar? Are they at the point where their network is big enough that they have an intelligence and therefore can have an intent? So maybe they're directing the seed.
So this is where I come back to the spore eaters and the idea that somehow the aether that is on the moon is able to influence what the spores are doing on the planet. And there is some knowledge of when the spore eater is in danger to be able to protect it. And it's like a relatively sophisticated knowledge in terms of when it protects the host and when it doesn't protect the host. And so that does make me think that somehow the aether on the moon has some kind of intent and is able to like exercise that intent on the spores. So then if someone like Zeiss is able to have a stronger intent, maybe he can control the spores and make them do something different than they usually do, being under the intent of the moon prime aether.
Okay. I know. I like this concept, is that someone can use the pathways that are currently being used by the prime aether to like protect their little spore eaters. And Zeiss, by understanding that pathway, can then use it to their own benefit.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what he's trying to do. He's trying to understand if there is a intelligent intent that is creating the seed, then maybe he can use that to his benefit. Obviously, on that planet, with so much trade being reliant on ships moving around, if you could shut down a sea with your own intent, then you own that sea. Like, you are the controller of everything that goes on there. And that would be a wild amount of power to wield.
Yeah.
This is like making me think of how Vin was able to control the Koloss with like emotional allomancy. It feels like a very similar potential revelation of like, use this thing that doesn't seem like it really makes a connection or makes sense. And then just like, then you get that power over them. Yeah. You're also making me think of like a giant, like verdant spore Godzilla that like the moon can just make. Because they have control over their spores now.
Oh my gosh.
That's exactly what I'm imagining.
Giant spore monsters. Love that image.
All the spores come together to form Verdant Godzilla.
A big monster just comes out of the spore sea.
Coming out of the ocean, yes.
This is the future of the Cosmere that you asked about, people. Everything always ends in Godzilla. I think there is an important question to ask, though, about the future of the Cosmere, especially when it comes to something like Zephyr, which we believe is going to be useful in the space
travel.
Age. Yes. Is Lumar and the spores there going to become a really important way stop in the greater Cosmere?
Yeah, like a fueling station.
Maybe, yeah, some type of fueling station. And maybe just like every spore becomes valuable for something. And then it's like the number one trade destination. I don't know, Jen, how do you feel about like the greater Cosmere and the space age? Do you think that there will be a lot of cooperation and sharing? Or do you think it'll kind of be more, you know, like a war to like take resources from one place to another?
Well, I definitely think that it sounds to me like Lumar would have to become really valuable once people realize that they can, like, use the Zephyr Spores as fuel and all of that. Like, all of a sudden, everyone's going to be scrambling for this poor backwater planet.
Exactly. It's
just, like, living in peace.
Yeah.
maybe they already are, because Tress is from a backwater on her planet. So maybe back on the mainland, they're already doing all the trade, and we just don't know about it, because it is the space age when Tress takes place. Like, we have the rocket ship and stuff, so I don't know, maybe they're already using that and we just didn't see that in the story.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. I'm also just like, I'm so interested in space age Cosmere, because I really want to see, I assume, you know, there's going to be wars, and we already kind of know some of those two major superpowers and things. I want to see how different groups deal with the natural kind of different limitations that they have based off of what magic system they happen to have. Like, obviously, yeah, the Rosharans have surge binding, and they're going to find some way to use Fabrials and surge binding and stuff to, like, make their ships. And then over on Skadrial, we're going to have Allomancy powering ships. And then over here, we're going to have Spores powering ships. Mm-hmm. And I can only assume that there's going to be, like, different effective, and which one's the most effective, which one's the most efficient in doing something. Like, which one is just, you know, intrinsically got the best ammunition, which one's got the best fuel. And like you asked, Tyler, like, I don't know if they'll be able to share these things, or if they'll start hoarding the ones that are really useful to them. I feel like when you have access to, you know, the surge of pressure, like the gravitation and pressure one, like, that's going to help you a lot, like,
yeah,
in building ships. And what do you, you know, when your enemy doesn't have access to that, I wonder if that becomes, you know, that's a weakness that your tactics in warfare can exploit, whereas they can't exploit it because you have that surge. Like, I just think all of that will be so, so interesting.
Yeah. And then also how the different magic systems get packaged and exported. So if, mm-hmm, Rishar, you know, is creating their Risharan spaceship, but then they get a cube, like we see in the second era of Mistborn, that's able to kind of transport different allomantic powers, then how does that, mm-hmm, interface with the surges, like, in their Risharan spaceship?
Things, yeah,
get, like, really wild, and it's so exciting.
The, mm-hmm, ability to think of, like, a simple Fabrial that Navani or someone is developing right now on Rishar eventually being like a Rube Goldberg machine, where it's, like, hitting different things, and every time it, like, falls onto a new item that's powered by a different magic system. Mm. And so you, like, drop over here to trigger some spores, and that goes up to an Awaken machine, and then that comes down to an Elantrian, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that's my long-term hope, but I do think that we're going to see a lot more
individual. I mean, I think it's going to be even better than that. I feel like that's, like, step one. Tress is already making Rube Goldberg machines with her spores. Navani is going to be able to make, like, a computer.
Well, we see computers, you know, in this future, and the sorceress and her seemingly Elantrian ship that she has.
Yeah.
But it also has some borrowed mechanics. And we've talked previously about, like, what does it mean to awaken something? Does that mean it comes from Nalthus specifically?
Yeah.
Or can you, quote unquote, awaken something with enough investiture of any type?
Yeah.
All of these questions kind of leave open a lot of possibilities. But right now, I think what we have been exposed to mostly is individual ships, or, you know, individual planets creating a ship for themselves, and not necessarily the perfect ship that I'm imagining, that's like the Star Trek universe, where everybody's kind of just working together to explore the Cosmere.
And of course,
there's got to be one of those perfect ships someday. Someday we'll get
someday one. Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully, right? You hope everyone can just, like, work together and make the best thing.
I would love if we got to a Star Trek future and it's just like, boldly go where no one has gone before, and then they just shoot out outside of the Cosmere in,
oh,
you know,
no,
from one galaxy to another. There's a lot of space apparently between them, and so it's just like the very end of the Cosmere is just going out into the broader
just
universe.
They sail into the sunset, in, yeah, quotes.
The multiple sunset of the whole universe.
But of course, we have the question of how much of the future technology in the Cosmere is going to be something that looks like our Earth technology running on electricity or radio waves, for example, and how much of it is going to be investiture only technology.
Ah, yes. Everybody's favorite
Our
game.
Classic argument.
Is it magic or is it technology sweeping the nation? Jen, we invite you to play along with us because, yeah, this really has divided us. And I didn't realize how much of this question was actually centered on Tress. A little bit with Stormlight as well. But yes, we see so many different Fabrials, which we would say, you know, have to include some part magic. It can be magic from any system, from my perspective.
But it runs on investiture.
Yes, it has some part investiture. But on Scadrial, mainly on Scadrial, but some other instances as well, we see what I would just label as regular technology. These are mechanical inventions. Yes, some of that could include electricity. So you get something like a radio, but it's not a magical radio. It's just a radio.
It's literally just using radio waves just like an Earth radio.
Yes, and so my concept, very similar to what I said about wanting the perfect ship where everyone's working together, is I want technology mixed with magic, and I want them to coexist. So you have like a computer that is powered by electricity, and it does something with magic to amplify, I don't know, the graphics processor or like the connection to other people. So instead of like connecting on the internet, you have a connection circuit that's awakened in some way, but the base is still electrical.
This is such a failure of imagination.
I think electricity is interesting. I like our rigged world and technology.
Why would I want a basic electric computer?
Because it works.
When I could have a magic computer that would probably be able to do so many more cooler, better, faster things.
I am not saying you shouldn't have a magic computer. I think they should develop technology and magical technology in
if
unison.
I've got magic, I'm leaving electricity by the wayside. Kick it out of the car. Goodbye.
I feel like electricity is basically magic, and it is useful in a lot of ways. And so people would be dumb to leave behind such an amazing tool. It would just be like, nah, we don't want that hammer, even though we have a bunch of nails that we need to hit. And I'll just like do it with my hand because my hand heals itself. And I'm like, that's correct.
That is a bad example. I want to know what Jen thinks.
If you, Tyler, or if Brandon can convince me that like an Earth non-magic based spaceship stands a chance in like the Cosmere War, I will be excited to see it play out. But somehow I just feel like it's going to be the first loser in the game. So
yes.
Whoever comes with Earth technology just gets immediately eliminated. Thanks for playing. Yeah,
I haven't really thought it through, but like my assumption is that magic is better. So it might be interesting to see if maybe it's not. Maybe we can find ways that electricity can be used to defeat the magic.
I like your optimism.
Yeah, that's mainly what it is. It's optimism.
Yeah,
because I don't think anybody's going to bring only mechanical or technological inventions. I think it's going to be incorporated into everything. But so that there are elements for most people across the Cosmere, they're not magical. They're not connected to any of the stories that we are exposed to.
How do you know?
Because most people in the Cosmere are just normal people. Just like most people on Earth are not.
Well, they're living on magical shard worlds.
Yes. And they might have exposure like on Nalthus. You know, everybody has a breath and they are well aware of how that system works. But I think that because the vast majority of people are just Cosmere normies, maybe not normal compared to Earth.
But one of the biggest themes that we're seeing as we move forward in the Cosmere is that investiture is being democratized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's only going to continue with things like Fabrials, where soon even lay people who are not Knights Radiant or not Allomancers, are going to have access to similar, if not the same, powers. And like one of the coolest things I think about being able to watch this galaxy of the Cosmere move forward in time and develop technology is watching kind of all the blocks come together of like, ooh, how are they going to build a computer if they don't use what we use on Earth? Like, they're not going to use computer chips. How do you build a computer out of conjoined gemstones and aluminum? Like, I think that is one of the most interesting things that I'm excited to discover along with the characters.
Well, let's bring in another person to this conversation. Brandon Sanderson. Perhaps you know of him. He had some thoughts on this exact conversation. He says, quote, I want to push Stormlight Archive more towards Magitek because I'm pushing Mistborn more towards Earth analog with Earth technology and then some cool fantastical things thrown in. But when you're using the technology, when you're using a radio on Scadrial, it's a radio. You know what a radio is. It works based on radio principles. And maybe you can do some wacky things with weight, but an airship is kind of an airship to them. Whereas I want on Rashar, which is the opposite end of the spectrum, when an airship is on Rashar, it's not an airship like you would imagine. It's not being propelled in normal ways. It's working off of all of these weird, magical things. End quote. Maybe the answer is on different planets, we're going to see different parts of the spectrum. On Rashar, yeah, it's going to be really weird and nothing is going to be quote unquote like a normal Earth machine. Mm-hmm. But other places in the Cosmere, especially maybe some of the more second tier Cosmere planets where they don't have a major shard influence,
yeah,
we could see more normal technology becoming widespread. And I think that that actually is as exciting to me as maybe magic tech is to you, or Fabrial tech is to you, because like you mentioned, the democratization of power needs to be springboarded by something. What better to do that than just technology in general? Spread out the powers.
Boring.
Jen, how are your thoughts developing? Because you said you're a fan of like the space age Cosmere. Mm-hmm. How do you want to see Magitek develop over time? Or what are you most excited about?
Are we allowed to talk about arithmetists on this podcast?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Another one of Brandon's series, not directly connected to the Cosmere, just for anyone who is unaware. Go ahead, Jen.
I mean, one of my favorite things about Arithmetist, and one of the many reasons that we were all sad that we don't have a sequel to the Arithmetist, was that in that story, what had happened was they had never discovered electricity. They had never, like, the light bulb thing had never happened. And so, like, back before that, don't quote me on how this all works. I'm not a historian, but back before that, they had clockwork technology and they were working on developing much more advanced clockwork technology. And we just kind of threw it aside once we found electricity and started using that instead. And so in the Arithmetist, you have them building like cars and horses and all these things with this clockwork technology without any electricity involved. And I thought this was really interesting and I wanted to see more of it because it's really a very minor part of that story.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I'm like, it doesn't have to be magic. I just want to see things that are not Earth analogous because I kind of agree with you, Brooke, that I'm like, if it's Earth, it's boring.
Yeah, like, boring. I see that all the time.
Yeah. So if it has Earth technology, great. If one of them just decides to go that clockwork direction so that Brandon can satisfy my clockwork need without having to write a arithmetist sequel, fine. Like that, I'm good with all of it.
Love it.
Absolutely love it. I am definitely a fan of that as well. Let's leave technology behind and go over to a more personal note. Everybody's favorite friend, Mr. Hoyd, he makes, well, the main appearance. He is the storyteller in Tress. And he also gives a little bit of information about his backstory. Never as direct as we want, but certainly more than I was expecting from Tress.
Yeah.
And also alluding back to the big moment, the shattering that we hope to gain some knowledge about in Stormlight Archive 5.
We shall see. But Hoyd says, quote, for your own good, you see. Ah, those words. I've heard those words. I've said those words. The words that proclaim in bald-faced arrogance, I don't trust you to make your own decision. The words we pretend will soften the blow, yet instead layer condescension on top of already existent pain, like dirt on a corpse. Oh yes. I've said those words. I said them with 16 other people, in fact. End quote. And this is such a fascinating detail about the Shattering and Hoyd's place in the Shattering. And I don't entirely know what it means. Apparently, Hoyd and these 16 other people said, for your own good, to...
Who?
Who?
What?
Yeah. My interpretation was that they were saying it to kind of the Cosmere in general, like the general you all of you, it's for your own good that we are going to shatter ad nauseam.
They're kind of like taking the responsibility, this burden upon themselves for the greater good.
For the good of the Cosmere.
A greater good.
But Tyler had a different interpretation.
Yeah, I didn't think about it that way at all. I thought this was very personal, and it was kind of like a moment of personal insight from Hoyt, because I felt that this paragraph was very directed at almost an individual, I'll say. I don't necessarily think that Ad Nauseam is a specific individual or a specific vessel like we see with the shards, but I also just got the vibe here that when he's saying for your own good, it's I'm doing this, shattering you for your own good. It's going to be your death, or it's going to be bad for you.
Yeah,
but I'm still saying that it's for your own good. And that's why it's such a undercut. That's why it's so hurtful. And because it's
I don't think that makes sense. I think partially because, to your point, we don't really know if Ad Nauseam had a vessel or a wielder of any kind, or if it was a you. And then secondarily, I don't see how anyone could justify saying for your own good when it very clearly was going to not be for their own good.
Yes, but the second part of the quote to me is where I'm kind of like getting this really personal connection. You're softening the blow. I feel like you don't need to soften the blow if you're doing something for the greater good, because you've rationalized it for the greater good. So there is no softening of the blow. You're just doing what is quote unquote right. You're throwing dirt on a corpse. That's like the most personal type of thing one can do, you know, just like to bury another human being. Very direct, very emotional. And that's kind of like the vibe that I've got, that he's sad about this, that he said for your own good, and it was wrong of him to do so. And I'm wondering, Jen, where do you fall kind of like within that spectrum?
Well, I never thought about it the way that Brooke did, but it does make sense. And what you're saying makes sense about how, like, if it's a person, it's never going to be for your own good to kill you. So I suppose if he's talking to Ad Nauseam, that seems like it would be a confirmation to me that Ad Nauseam is a force instead, and it's for your own good. And, you know, Ad Nauseam's not actually going away. It's just going to be shattered into these pieces, but it'll still technically exist. And for some reason, that's for its own good. That starts to feel really like the whole Aerialli, like the one thing, and, broken up so you can have all these experiences, and then maybe one day you'll come back together. I don't really like any of the theories that are about Ad Nauseam being reforged. I just don't like it. So I don't know. I could go maybe with yours, Brooke, and that it's for everybody, because I didn't really hear it in that sense. But at the same time, like, logically, that one makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, because I think my imagination is that maybe this group of people had an issue with there being like one supreme power in the world. And so it's a little bit almost like Mistborn, kind of fractal, of like this group of people is like, ah, this emperor, this one person in power, like, must be terrible. We will destroy it. So they shatter it for the good of everyone. And then I think it's safe to say that that didn't go as planned, maybe, or like didn't turn out as good as maybe they hoped it would. And my impression of most of the vessels is that they did this selfishly and like wanted power for themselves, and therefore shattered Ad Nauseam. And the for your own good is the band-aid to say like, no, I'm not doing something selfish for power. I'm doing it for you, to help the Cosmere, obviously.
I think it's probably like a 50-50 situation where like half of them were secretly being very selfish and had no qualm, you know, very much knew they were being selfish, but they were just hiding it. And then maybe the other half, that includes Hoyt, is the half that's convinced that it's for the greater good. And obviously it doesn't go as planned, because half of them are not being honest about it.
Exactly.
They immediately all start breaking their rules.
Exactly. We already know that, like, most of them immediately were just like, oh, just kidding. We're going to pair up and, like, we're going to do all the things we said we weren't going to do.
Yeah. So if Hoyt was an Aerialli, if he was the first, he's the first believer in Aerialli-ness, it would kind of line up with their basic belief that there was a singular god, and that god needed to be broken up so that they could gain the experiences of the many, which is in capital letters to them. And eventually in the future, after a long trail, there will be reassembling into that one. We can imagine ourselves, if like the Aerialli are 100% correct and Hoyt's the first one, it seems like we're in the middle of that process. We had a one, now we have a many, and there's a potential of a uniting and everything comes back together. It's almost because it seems like they're so right that I want to reject
it. Wrong.
I get that same vibe that you had, Jen, of just like not quite wanting to go back to the singular one and that like ultimate source of power. But I don't know what would be better. I certainly don't think that a Terravodium running around with killing shards is a great solution to any type of problem. But I am curious, I don't know, how do we feel about the Irayali in general? Because after Brandon's reading at Dragonsteel, it seems like the Irayali have a big moment in Stormlight 5.
Definitely. And the Irayali were on Lumar at some point to bring us back to Tress. And this was another question from a patron asking just to talk about the Irayali. I think we're going to end up doing a full episode about the Irayali and kind of try to like track their long trail, because I have some questions about their trail and like
where we are on their
trail, right? Like, are we in the middle? I don't know if
it doesn't add up.
Yes, thank you. I feel like there's more stops on the trail than there's supposed to be. And maybe that's just because we don't know for sure what the timeline is. But I found a word of Brandon when I was researching for this episode that kind of threw me for a loop. Quote, "You mentioned that the Irayali were once on the planet," meaning Lumar, "but with the 12 moons, can we also assume that this is where the Thalens got their 12 base number system and nautical skills?"
And Brandon responds, "Rafo, excellent, excellent question," end quote.
This kind of blew my mind. I don't know what to make of it. Do we think that the Thalens also originally came from not Rishar and immigrated? Did they inherit their 12 base number system from the Irayali in some way, like once they both were on Rishar, which would mean that the timeline is completely different and Tress would actually be taking place before the Stormlight Archive, like by a lot?
What are your thoughts on that, Jen?
I don't know, like the Irayali are really interesting, and I'm pretty convinced that there must be like multiple groups of them doing this long trail and not being on the same path at all. Like they're going to totally different planets and they're thinking that they're maybe that I mean, knowing their religion, maybe they're completely okay with that and they're like, yeah, it's not like there's seven specific lands, it's just like you got to go to seven lands and maybe the seventh one is intended to be like they all end up in the same place,
like they all have to go on their own pilgrimage,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, but it's like somehow this doesn't work, because we know from the whole like Zeiss is in the prologue of Rhythm of War, it says that like on Lumar, like that's what Chris says.
Yeah,
so it's like he's already there, but then Tress says that the Irayali left 300 years before, but then
which is when Zeiss arrives, right?
Yeah, don't they, but like don't that's they... also like we know they're on Roshar 300 years before the events of Rhythm of War. They've been on Roshar, as far as I can tell, for like seven millennia. Like they're a silver kingdom of the olden days, so it seems like they've always been on Roshar. So I'm like, it seems like there must be multiple groups of these guys. I don't know.
Yeah, I love the concept of multiple groups of Irayali, and it does strike me as like going along with their religion of just like, yeah, there are many of us, there we're on a pilgrimage of sorts, a lifetime pilgrimage to like visit these seven lands. And again, based on that reading from Brandon, don't want to just straight up spoil everything. If you haven't read it, go out and, you know, check that. But like they might get called to transit, and then like that's their signal, just like we are the people who go when called. When there's a signal, we go to the next land. And therefore, maybe it doesn't have to be always the people we think of as the Irayali, or like the ones with golden flecks in their hair.
No, it's always the people with gold hair. That's how they're mentioned every time they're mentioned.
Yes, but if the Thalens were people who like either met the Irayali, adopted some of their culture, or understood something about Lumar, I guess we're also forgetting that there are the Aethers themselves, the Prime Aethers.
Yeah.
There's also 12 of those.
Yeah.
So the Thalens could be connected to that source rather than directly to Lumar.
I mean, yeah, I guess maybe.
That gets us out of the time problem that we're having, the timeline issue, as there seems to be more and more in the Cosmere.
Because you would think that if there was another group of people who immigrated to Rishar, that would show up in the mythology somewhere. But I feel like we haven't heard of any Rasharan mythology of a new group of people coming from the stars or appearing out of thin air from the cognitive realm or something to explain that the Thalens would have been on Lumar and then arrived on Rashar. But they've also lost a lot of history, to be fair, since their society has been reset a billion times.
I mean, 12, a 12-base system and the kind of the nautical skills. And Brandon does say Rafo. He doesn't confirm anything. Make this mistake more than once in the past of just like, Rafo, that means absolutely
that
yes.
That must mean something important. And then it's like, no, not at all.
But yeah, I wonder if it's...
I'm inclined to think it's not the Aerialli, but yeah, something with the Aethers and just that being a really ancient system of 12 and somehow they picked that up.
Let's close out with what I think is a really important element of Tress is we have a Hoid. We don't have a design.
Yeah.
What's going on with design?
See, this also makes me wonder about the timeline here. Okay. I kind of like the idea that maybe Tress is in the past, even though we think it's in the future.
There's no design, is what you're saying.
And there, yeah, this is before a Hoid bonded design.
But there's spaceships on Lumar.
Yes, but Elantris happened a long time ago.
Okay.
We have no idea what they've been up to, what they've invented. I think they're clearly well advanced from the rest of the Cosmere by the fact that the things we see them doing in secret history.
Jen, do you think that this existence, non-existence of design is important in establishing where we are in the timeline? Or is there a more casual explanation where just, you know, she was still on Rashar or something else? She was hanging out in a noodle shop. I don't know.
I mean, I think that I'm pretty sure that Tress is after Stormlight. I can't really, you know, like pinpoint reasons, but I'm not really like convinced that it could possibly be happening before the Stormlight books. But I'm also like, I'm not super worried about where design is. Like I, you know, maybe Brandon will surprise me and be like, she died. she didn't die because she's there in Yumi. But yeah. like maybe he'll surprise me and tell me that something like horrible had happened to design. And that's why she's like not here. But I'm more inclined to think that, yeah, she's in a noodle shop or maybe before she went to the noodle shop, maybe she was doing curry. Maybe she was doing something else. Like she's just over there in the cognitive realm, just like chilling out. I don't know. I'm not too worried about her, but it is an interesting question.
I think that I'm going to jump over to another book series, one of my longtime favorites, His Dark Materials. Mm. And there is, I will not spoil that whole series, but there's a relationship between the humans and a magical spirit animal that they have. And one of the plot points is that to physically separate yourself from your spirit animal hurts. And it's not something that people do, and torture can be involved to like pull people apart. Not great. Don't want it to happen. Kind of that relationship exists between Spren and their bonded Radiant. It's not as direct as in that story, but it is a like actual connection that can, when severed, physically hurt or kill both parties.
Yeah, it's painful.
I think if Hoid was able to figure out a way to get off Rashar, which clearly he has done, that might have involved a severing, hopefully not too painful, but a severing of design and basically freeing her from Hoid, but not breaking their bond.
Oh.
That's the kind of the key difference is that what I'm imagining. Yeah. Is she's basically okay. She's fine in her noodle shop doing curry, whatever. But it is now happened, like she's sapient and herself, but able to be separate from Hoid in a far more direct way than we've seen.
Yeah, I think there's some manipulation of the bond that would have to happen to get Hoid off of Rashar after having bonded, at least from what we've learned so far in Oathbringer and Rhythm of War, about the nature of that bond and how investiture kind of ties you to a physical location. And we're all trying to figure out how we can hack the investiture to travel more. And so if Hoid found almost like a bond suppressor to like hide the bond from the universe and be like, no, let me just sneak through your physics limitations on investiture moving off of the planet.
Maybe you get something from Scadrial, some identity masker. Sure. You know, it kind of masks your identity, just that part that is bonded to something else.
Or just an aluminum box, right?
Like you put it around
just
yourself.
Just like they had the Sion in the aluminum box. Can you put a Spren in a box? I don't know if Spren can even go in a box.
That's an interesting
question.
Can
a cognitive entity go in a physical box?
Okay, Jen.
I'm like imagining that there's going to be like some DNA, like genome sequence thing that they get to where like they can map out every part of a person's identity and just be like, just cover that one. Like just that thing that connects you to Roshar is just like invisible right now.
Turn it off.
Yeah, that would be a very powerful Fabrial because we have.
Yeah. What is the magical version of CRISPR?
Yes, exactly. Kind of. Yeah. The CRISPR technology. But we've seen Fabrials that like dig into the body to like form a connection with the blood. And so I don't think it's that wild if he's like wearing a bracelet that is digging into, you know, his skin. That's basically, as you're saying, Jen, like identifying the parts of him spiritually that are connected to design and just suppressing the bond enough so that it doesn't weigh him down to Roshar in the way we think that it does to everyone right now.
Yeah. Wow. Good questions that this whole design situation brings up.
I think that Tress in general brings up a lot of great questions about the Cosmere. It is such a lovely story in that way that it can be read with no other connection to the Cosmere, just kind of like read straight.
Yeah. But in some ways it's very sweet and simple.
But as we have just shown, you can bring on a guest and talk about it for more than an hour and not even get close to all the different stuff that was seen in that story. And we're going to come back to this. We're going to return to Yumi and we're going to turn to the Sunlit Man, all in preparation for the Stormlight Archive and the big release later this year. I think that's going to do it for now. We're going to be back next time with a lot of Word of Brandon, a lot of spoiler stuff, and talking about what's been going on with the Leatherbounds and the newly announced secret project. Jen, thank you so much for coming in and having this conversation and just being such an articulate lover of the Cosmere. It's been really wonderful.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun to just kind of theorize and discuss with all of you. You guys are great.
Brooke, can you take us away?
Until next time, life before death.
Strength before weakness.
Journey before destination.